We're going to go ahead and get started with our Sundays with Andy that is running through the full run of this exhibition, Andy Warhol, The Last Decade. So glad you're all here. We've had a wonderful response to this program, and it's no surprise because we have such talent in the North Texas area by way of artists. I had no trouble coming up with 14 very talented artists to lead an individual tour every Sunday, as I said, through the run of the show, and there were plenty of artists that I had to leave off the list because I only had 14 weeks. So we hope to continue this program in a slightly more modified form in coming years. So be on the lookout for the artist-led tours as they relate to special exhibitions. This week, we are so happy to have with us the artist, Daryl Lassiter. Daryl is originally from New York and comes to us most recently by way of Houston. He is a professor of intermedia, / sculpture program at UTA. He's an artist working with digital media, printmaking, sculpture, and installation. Currently, he's working on a commissioned project with the Philadelphia Museum of Art and has exhibited nationally, including, and I'll just give you the Texas connections since we want to give him as much time as possible today. Texas connections being the Barry Whistler Gallery in Dallas, the CAM, the Contemporary Art Museum in Houston, the Dallas Center for Contemporary Art, and he has work in the collection of the MFA Houston, again, just to name a few. He's received numerous grants and residencies, including a residency this coming summer that culminates in an exhibition at the Wassaic Artist Project pertaining to his work with the Samuel Gray Society. And I encourage you to Google Samuel Gray Society. I think you will enjoy it very much, especially on the heels of having to hear what Daryl has to say about Andy Warhol. Daryl's work is based in the research of American history and mythology, which I think gives him a very interesting perspective on Andy Warhol, The Last Decade. So with that, I'll turn it over to Daryl, and we'll go see Andy Warhol.
Thanks for coming out, folks. Thank you. I thought I would go ahead and get started right in the gallery. Not that it's not nice out here, but let's go see some art, shall we? So I'd first of all just like to thank Terry Thornton for having me here and thank the Fort Worth Modern Museum for not only hosting me, but hosting this exhibition, which I feel to be not only significant, but extremely powerful and compelling. As Terry mentioned to you, I'm an artist. And so as opposed to coming at this work from an art historical perspective, what I thought I might be able to offer to you all is an argument for why I believe it's important to me as an artist, and how Warhol's art in general not only speaks to the time in which it was created, but also within the case of the works of this particular gallery, speaks very fluently to the canon of art and to the process of art making in the postmodern era. And the works in this particular gallery, which we'll walk through, range from the 70s and the 80s. So that's the time period that I'll be focusing most closely on. However, to start, I thought I would begin with something that is more than 2,000 years old. How many of you have ever read a little Plato? Yeah? Okay, great. I'd like to start by talking about Plato's Republic of all things. So we're going to go half the world away, and we're going to go back in time about 2,000 years. When Plato wrote his Republic, he organized, in essence, a dialectic, a philosophical document, around his teacher Socrates and several of Socrates' philosopher friends. It was a document which took as its meaning, or as its directive, the strategy of making what these philosophers wanted to describe or organize as a perfect city. And so within that perfect city, they argued and discuss deeply the residents or the denizens of that city, and amongst them, the artists. And I've always remembered as an artist, Socrates speaking within the Republic, that the greatest artists are those that hold a mirror to the world. And I thought that that was an appropriate place to start, because indeed what I think Warhol does most successfully is hold that mirror to the world. And I do believe that it's very important, particularly in this kind of postmodern realm that most artists are making work within today, for artists to be cultural critics, at least in part. Warhol was, and I think his work testifies to the fact that he felt very deeply about this role as a cultural critic and as an artist giving us this mirror through which we could view ourselves. I think that's Warhol's perhaps greatest legacy as an artist. He gives us who we are through his own artistic filter. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the next 45 minutes or so. And while I'm doing it, I want to say that if this turns into more of a conversation as opposed to me talking to you, great. Please, if you have any questions or want to chime in at any one time, please do so. I'm making an argument. My argument has holes in it. Okay, I'll admit that freely. So, you know, throw something out if you'd like to, because I think that's another thing that Warhol gives us in his work, is room for dialogue and room for debate. So on the nature of this artist as mirror, what I'd like to particularly focus on in this gallery, we're going to kind of spend our time right here, is a particular kind of mirror that Warhol gives us. Because if Warhol's work provides this mirror through which we can view ourselves, and in a larger sphere, Americanness, if you will, allow me that made-up word, this room gives us a funhouse mirror. It gives us a mirror that is based largely in humor, that is both pointed, but also in some cases a bit silly. It offers us a parody of many things through which we can, I hope, see some truths. And one of the things that I like about the way Warhol focuses his humor within this gallery is that it is largely pointed at the world of art. It's pointed at other things too, which I'll try to argue for in a bit, but it's pointed first and foremost at the artistic realm, which I greatly appreciate as an artist, because in a way Warhol is speaking, at least I like to think, Warhol is speaking a bit to me personally. But he's also challenging some of the very things that I, as an artist, have grown up holding sacred. And I greatly appreciate that. And that's where that critical discourse comes in, I think. That's where the role of artist as cultural critic becomes very, very valuable in Warhol's work. Okay. So I'm going to start at the messiest point. And I'm going to start with the two oxidation paintings that are here flanking this beautiful Rorschach painting. I'll get to the Rorschach paintings in a little bit, but I thought I'd talk about the oxidation paintings. And as I mentioned, I want to make the argument that Warhol is challenging not only many of our own definitions of American culture and Americanness, challenging notions of who we are, speaking to these things, but he's also doing it first and foremost through the canon of art. And at this time, and in fact much of the work in this room, is taking on a very specific, at least I'm going to argue, a very specific discipline or movement within the arts, and that's abstract expressionism. And Warhol was very, very, very keenly aware, for all of Andy's desire to deny his intellectual rigor in interviews and publicly. I think it's difficult to argue against the fact that Warhol was one of the five, perhaps 10, smartest artists of the 20th century. So much of my argument today will be based on the assumption of Andy's intellectual rigor and his prowess as a very, very, very savvy critically minded artisan. And I don't know that you could deny that. I really don't. But now to the oxidation paintings. You may have noticed if you came to look at these paintings that the chief medium is urine. Okay, and I think it's a very, very valid question to ask yourself why an artist would choose urine as the chief media for art making. And I'm starting at the messiest place, and in a way I'm also starting at the most complex place. So it's going to take me a minute, I think, to maybe make sense of this, if indeed there's sense to be made. The works date 1978, and Warhol made an entire series of oxidation paintings wherein he in some cases used his own, and in some cases apparently used the urine of friends, to create these non-objective and abstract marks that indeed are process-oriented through the chemical oxidation process of copper meeting urine and the way that that would then patina the coppered pigment onto these works. So first and foremost, as a bit of an irreverent character, I think about Warhol in the role of art critic peeing on art, right? There is that humor to it, and I don't think that we should be able to deny ourselves that kind of happy moment, that little joke in our heads. As works of art, these certainly would find themselves in the genre of abstraction, and I think it's important to think about that for a minute, because in 1949, Life magazine published the very, very famous four-page centerfold of Jackson Pollock. This was the same year when Andy Warhol moved to New York. Okay. He would have obviously seen this magazine, and of course he would be familiar with Pollock's work, Pollock was working in Long Island at the time, just outside of New York. And Pollock has become this figure, part myth, part real, the celebrity of the abstract art world at the time. The same way that Warhol focuses on the celebrity of people like Elvis, for instance, or people like Marilyn, Pollock can be understood to have that kind of presence within the realm of art making circa 1950 or so, until his death in 1956 in New York. And of course, many of you know, if not all of you know, how Pollock made his work, right? Pollock's work used gravity. Right. Pollock was among the first, if not the first, artist to put a canvas on the floor and allow something to drip over it. Well, you might be asking yourself, what other fluids drip? That's how we might get here, right? So this might be Warhol taking it to Pollock a little bit and having some fun with the nature of abstract expressionism. Of course, abstract expressionism also favored emotion. It favored this romantic quality of somehow the artist's soul being imbued into the work over other things such as the intellectual process or the editing process. Right? So Warhol might be having some fun here. If you look at this particular canvas closely, you'll also notice some funny things that he starts doing that I believe are fully, fully intentional. First of all, we are presented with a grid, which is another important modernist discourse, the use of the grid. You might think of Agnes Martin, for instance, who's represented in this collection, who is most known for her very beautiful paintings that utilize grids and play, mathematical play. But what you'll certainly notice very quickly is that this is actually an anti-grid. It's a lousy grid. If one of my students made this grid, they would not pass this assignment, right? And that's intended. I believe that that's absolutely intended, and that's Warhol having some fun. Having some fun with modernism, okay? It's almost anti-formal in that sense, that formal issues were so significant to so many modernist artists and so many minimalist artists. So he's kind of throwing a gauntlet down at abstract expressionism, but also aspects of modernism, playing with it, right? Sticking a finger in the canon of sacred art discourse, in that sense. the grid as a whole is hopelessly out of square, right? Every painter knows that the first thing you have to master before you get to a painting is being able to stretch a square canvas, right? It's hopelessly out of square. And its nature of being out of square is made even more evident by the fact that it's actually installed in a rather beautiful and perfectly square frame. These are not accidents. These are very intended, I believe. The other thing I want to say is that if you're going to make an argument for Warhol being a really savvy, critically minded artist, and I am, it's also important to note the date on many of these things and the context of art making in New York that surrounds these works in and of themselves. The date here is 1978. It's 6 years after Vito Acconci creates his now very, very well-known Seedbed piece at Sonnabend Gallery in New York. This was a work, and I'm going to have to use a little bit of adult terminology here, so forgive me if there's any young folks out there. But this is a piece wherein Vito Acconci placed himself under the gallery floor and masturbated as often as possible for a period of many days as the gallery visitors walked above him, and through loudspeakers, he moaned and spoke quietly about all things from fantasy to a kind of personal narrative. Okay, so this is not a first in terms of the use of bodily fluids in the process of art making. In fact, you can make an argument that one of the quotes that Warhol's making here also goes as far back to Duchamp's Fountain, which, of course, for many artists, broke the last rule of art making. When Duchamp put a men's urinal into an exhibition, allowing it to become sculpture, in essence, the final rule, which was that an artist had to, at the very least, make his or her work, was broken. Right? Now, I think that might be a stretch. I don't know that this may go back as far as Duchamp. But I certainly think that artists like Vito Acconci are a part of this work, as is the gay bathhouses might be in New York, which are very, very popular at this time and are described in literature from, among other people, John Recchi in his well-known work, The Rushes, which dates to the late 60s, if I'm not mistaken. So there are precedents taking place here. And another one of the things that you might think about in terms of just how this might refer to America and how this might refer to all of us. You might think about the nature that we as Americans have with our bodies. It's kind of tortured, right? It's kind of awkward. It's tense. And we have great arguments and debates in this country about how sexual we want to present ourselves, the appropriate nature of the exploration of things like puberty, sexual adulthood. We are one of the few countries in the world that actually don't have a marked puberty rite that individuals will go through marking their transition to adulthood. Right? We have vigorous debates about the nature of sexual education in schools in this country. And in fact, while our advertising uses sex to sell everything from beer to popcorn, it gets kind of stuffed down in many other aspects of our society. And I don't know the reasons for this. It might be because we're a very religious people. It might be because of our Puritan heritage. It might be any number of things. But I think it's difficult to deny that as Americans, we have this relationship with our bodies, and perhaps even more significantly, the things that come out of our bodies, that is at the very least tense and in many cases filled with angst or anxiety, perhaps the best word. So that's my little blurb about these oxidation paintings and why I find them interesting, why I find them compelling, and why I do think they offer a way for me to access not only what I'm about as an artist, but I think what the American culture in many ways is struggling through and struggling with in terms of what is and what is not appropriate, not only in terms of public discourse, but also as the media for art making. I've been here for a little bit today, and I've watched a lot of people grimace and go up and read this and go, ugh, and walk away. I think in part that's what Warhol wanted. He wanted a little of that. And I think that that's okay, because the work is challenging and made to be challenging on that level. Does anyone have a comment or a question about this before we tackle yarn? Cool. All right, let's take a look at what's down here. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about these pieces entitled Yarn from 1983. He also made some into 1984. And again, I think it's impossible to look at this work without thinking about Pollock. The works were made in such a way as Warhol and his assistants soaked, impregnated yarn with dyes, with pigments, and then laid them onto the canvas to produce a transfer print, so to speak, wherein the yarn is the active brush, if you will, in the making of these works. As I mentioned, Pollock is certainly known for this, and Life magazine famously referred to him as Jack the Dripper in that 1949 article. What I think is beautiful about this work is, again, it's Warhol having a lot of fun with an artist who is 70% myth and maybe 30% real when it comes to the history of American art. An artist who in many ways can be understood to be, or is understood, to be just dripping with raw testosterone, with angst, riddled by demons, and in many ways is understood to be this kind of rogue genius, who of course died very tragically at what can be argued his own hand. What's nice about the way Warhol attacks this particular movement in art is that he's also bringing in a counterpoint to much of the bravado that we now associate abstract expressionism with. In 1971, Judy Chicago and Miriam Shapiro started the first feminist art program at Fresno State College, which was then transferred to CalArts. This was kind of a seminal moment that founded, in many ways, the movement of feminist art from the 70s to the present. Among the strategies that Shapiro and Chicago used in terms of providing the freedom for these women to express their very raw and emotional feminist concerns into the larger world of art was through the use of craft, or what can also be discussed as, woman's work. And by that I mean many of these artists began re-exploring traditional gender-based crafts such as quilting, sewing, knitting, cleaning in many cases, and the like. So these young women out in California working with Judy Chicago and Miriam Shapiro were utilizing these domestic applications of making and challenging, in many ways, this professional art world, largely founded in New York and Los Angeles at the time, that was shadowed in masculinity, that was predominantly male, right? And that utilized male things like scale, like heaviness, as a visual input to speak to various qualities of the male role, I think. It's not there directly, but it's there indirectly in most of the works that I'm referencing. So Warhol recreates Pollock using yarn, using a non-traditional art material, but also using a material that would be traditionally associated with craft or hobby work or woman's work, which I have to think is a direct reference to the organization of this first feminist art program in the 70s, which kind of took the world by storm and has become a really, really important counterpoint to much of the discourse on modernism and abstract expressionism that is dominated by male artists. Again, digging up Pollock, playing a little bit with the myth and the machismo embedded in the myth of Pollock, and bringing it back in such a way that we can look through it as if it were a mirror and begin to dissect it for the sum of its parts, as opposed to it being sacred, unchallengeable in that way. What I also find striking about these works visually is that, and by the way, I'm a big fan of Pollock. I hope that none of you start thinking I don't like Pollock. I do like making a little fun of Pollock because I think we should all make a little fun of all of us. It's a very human thing to do. And I think that Warhol is doing it here, which is why I seem to be on him so much. But one thing I would like to say is that a good Pollock, and, you know, there are very few bad Pollocks, but they're around. A good Pollock is actually quite deep. While he painted in a manner that was not representational and not illusionistic, one of the fascinating things that arises from a good Pollock painting is that there's a great deal of depth of space. The way that those lines and colors weave into and out of themselves allows for one to think about very, very deep visual space as one approaches the work. Scale helps as well. These works, as a counterpoint, are extremely flat. So even as Warhol is thinking about Pollock, and I think it's undeniable that he is, in Warhol's own way, he's denying what Pollock offers to the canon of art history by denying the typical depth that Pollock achieves with his work. Warhol, an artist who's known for his flatness, remains true to that, to the nature of that flat surface quality in these works, even as he's speaking to abstract expressionism. What do y'all think? Yeah? You're buying it so far? You with me? Okay. let's talk about the Rorschach paintings. I think that's nice. So again, it's important. I want to make this argument that the dates matter here. 1984. It was known that Warhol was actually sketching some of these at a much smaller scale, much earlier in his life, but saved the making of this work for this decade. I think that there's a reason why, and I think I've discovered it, and I hope I get famous for doing so. 1983, William Poundstone published a book entitled Big Secrets. This work purported to give away some of the greatest mysteries of our era, including the recipe for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and for the first time within this book, the 10 original Rorschach prints that had been used since the date 1911 by Herman Rorschach, the creator of this psychological test, were printed in popular media. A year before these prints were made, this book was published offering these 10 prints available to public consumption. I refuse to believe that that's a coincidence. Refuse. Warhol was probably more attracted to the book for its KFC recipe than perhaps the Rorschach prints originally. However, I just refuse to believe that that's coincidental. So, how many of you knew the history, or how many of you know the history of the Rorschach test? Yeah? Come on. No, I'm joking. there are 10 prints, and only 10, that are used by psychologists to get to as a means to kind of enter someone's unconscious and draw from their psyche aspects about their personalities that would typically be covered, shadowed, kept quiet, suppressed. And the Rorschach test, ever since its inception, a little less than 100 years ago, has been riddled with controversy. There are as many clinical psychologists that you can find out there, behavioral psychologists, who think that the Rorschach test is a bunch of malarkey, as there are those who think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Okay, so it's a highly controversial thing, used in almost 25% of all clinical studies with regard to attempting to get a grasp on various psychological disorders. There are some doctors who believe in this test so much that this is not so much true anymore. But in the past, believe that it could actually forecast cancer. That particular responses to these splotches could actually forecast cancer in a patient, which I find, you know, that's a subject for a whole other conversation, right? So, what's it all about? Well, you probably all know that the Rorschach test is meant to present to the viewer an abstract or non-objective form, and your response to that form becomes, in essence, a piece of information that a professional can use to kind of get inside your brain, to put it bluntly, to put it loosely. And of course, not only is your response measured, but how long it takes for you to respond is measured, and the emotional nature of your response is also a part of the calculation. It strikes me that this is exactly what we do with abstract and non-objective art, right? I do it all the time. I go look at an Yves Klein, and I think, yeah, I'm underwater. Or I go look at a Mark Rothko, and I say, that's a landscape, right? So the nature of Warhol's use of the Rorschach test, the Rorschach ink blot, is a perfect parody to the way in which we as viewers interact with abstract and non-objective art. As human beings, we try to find something real in something that is inherently not real. Try as you might in front of a Mark Rothko to find a landscape. That's not what Mark Rothko intended, at least in as much as I know his work. And try as you might to find something recognizable in a non-objective image, the artist's intent is to render no object. It's kind of there in the title, right? But we as human beings, it's something about us. We're wired that way. We want to see something in something. We want to personify what is, in many ways, meant to deny exactly that. So I think that this is a brilliant move, first and foremost, on Warhol's part. He's playing with us. He's playing with our desire to find something in non-objective and abstract art the way that we're supposed to find something in this hopelessly abstract print, of which there were originally 10, that are supposed to tell us, in many ways, if we're crazy or not. Right? So what do you all see? I don't know. The way in which these were made is with Warhol and his assistants. He painted down one side, folded the canvas in half, and then opened it and stretched it, which is why that you have, it's why you have this nice, on one hand, bilateral symmetry, But on another hand, what you'll see, and what I think you'll see in the camouflage works as well, is that within this system that should be perfectly bilateral symmetrical, it's not. Each half of this is unique in many ways because of the nature of that print. I find these works quite striking, and I find them compelling because it makes me think about what it is about our perception that causes us to desire to see things in things, right? We want to make sense of those things which are inherently meant to deny that. In this case, abstract and non-objective painting. And what I also like is the beauty of this installation, which is, you know, an art in and of itself, installing this show, allows you to look from this down there to the other very striking piece that bookend this wonderful gallery. And if you look at the two together, you can see that they actually have some very different qualities. This one's much more painterly, much more fluid. That one's much more graphic, much more controlled. Whereas that might be more akin to drawing, this seems more akin to painting. Yes? Yeah. I mean, I would think about it again, if you're talking about this, and I am, talking about this gallery as being one that's filled with humor, I think that you also have to talk about it in part as one that's being filled with joy and with play. And one of the reasons I might say that is because this is Warhol the artist working through various media, which are both physical, collaborative, and expressive. Can't believe I'm using that word. I didn't expect to use the word expressive today with Warhol. But expressive, in such a way as I think can be understood as the artist enveloped or re-enveloped at the end of his life in the joy of making. And part of that joy of making has everything to do with the joy of material and the movement back and forth between something active. So as much, I guess this is interesting, great question. As much as Warhol is playing, like sticking a finger in the ear of abstract expressionism in many of these works, he's also making work that is deeply expressive. And so he is charmed by it, seduced by it, as much as he is perhaps offering a parody of it, which then suddenly makes the work even more complex. Any other? Okay, I've got a little bit of time. I'd like to talk about the camouflage painting to end here. I'm kind of drawn to these camouflage paintings, and I wanted to end with this camouflage painting. And you can walk around the corner and see two very more smaller but beautiful ones as well. Because I think, in a way, we come full circle. We come back to, as I just expressed in the other room, the pure joy of making. And part of that joy for Warhol has always been, since the very first images he created, a joy of pattern and a joy of decoration, a pleasure of color and of form that is both very simple and very, very seductive. It's a seduction that comes out of, in my opinion, an interest in advertisement and the way bold colors and striking forms are used in advertising to catch the eye, to focus the eye, which of course makes us want to buy whatever it is we're focused on. But for Warhol, I think it's also about that interest in design, an interest in industry, that permeates much of his working process and permeated his life. Of course, he referred to his studio as the factory, as opposed to the studio. He brought a mechanization to his process and his vocabulary when talking about this. When you look at these camouflage works, you can clearly see, I'm going to try to do this without stepping over the white line, that there is a repetition of two large forms. One, 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 two, 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 one, 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 two, 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 across the entire piece. It is a grid, much like the grid that I first discussed in the oxidation series. The grid here is askew. It's a non-grid as much as it is a grid. And within that grid, we see all of the registration issues that would typically be referred to as flaws for professional printmakers. But we also see nuances, very subtle changes in tone, in hue, stray marks, mistakes, that are allowed to decorate, to embellish the work, which seek to remind us that this is an intimately handmade piece of art. It is not, for all of Warhol's desire for us to think of the factory and mechanization, something that is not without the most nuanced of human touch, and with it come all of the errors that we bring to the table as human beings with the finite capacity of our senses that, of course, mechanization eliminates. Right? The other kind of nice thing about this work, I mean, I think that's a very poetic way to look at it, and it does, that is how I look at it, and that's why this work is meaningful to me. But I think there's also, again, to bring the humor back into it, if you're going deer hunting and you're wearing this, you're coming home empty, folks. There's not much that's not going to be noticed about this type of camouflage, right? So what's interesting, I think, about Warhol's reuse of camouflage, and I'll bring it to art and then open it up larger, but there's a historical aspect at play here. In 1917, the U.S. Army created what was called the Camouflage Corps and enlisted artists to begin making camouflage patterns for not only the dress of soldiers, but also to decorate battleships with the hope that it would be a remedy towards submarine attack. Among some of these original artists enrolled in this camouflage corps were, let's see, there's an artist named Everett. Let me go to my cheat sheet, because I want to do this right. Everett Warner, an American impressionist, was among probably the most noted of these American artists who joined the camouflage corps. So there, believe it or not, there's an art historical component to the making of camouflage. I found that interesting. I'm sure Warhol knew it. I'm absolutely convinced Warhol knew it. And of course, Warhol reinvents camouflage with all the audacity of the color that he's known for, all of the pattern that he's known for. And believe it or not, I'm left thinking about his wig that he is most famous for wearing for most of his life. I've never seen a picture of him without his wig. Has anyone? Is there one here? Okay. There's one here. I should have known that. I wonder if Warhol thought of his wig as a way to camouflage himself, as a poor camouflage, as of course it became, because he became most famous for wearing it. But I wonder if there isn't an interest in Warhol's wearing of the wig and his implicit denial of what goes on in his head. You could kind of see that in some of the interviews in the back of this exhibition. An artist who was so interested in repressing publicly any measure of his intellectual rigor and the thought process that goes on in the creation of these works. I wonder if the wig wasn't a metaphor, wasn't yet another visual representation of very, very poor but expressive camouflage. If any of you read the three very wonderful essays that are part of the catalog of this exhibition, you will probably come across a very important footnote in the creation of these paintings, wherein Warhol was an artist who received death threats and, of course, was ultimately shot. In 1980, Warhol wrote in his diary that he had received a death threat, and he went to an Army-Navy store to check out some camo wear. I don't know if that may be what led to much of this work, because some of it predates that date. So I don't know. But it's certainly an interesting aspect to consider when you're looking at these pieces. And if you go around the corner, you'll see some that are even more garish, even more highly colored, even more electrified in terms of their patterning, to make them in many ways as visible as they are intended to be immediately invisible. At the end of the day, I think Warhol was someone who was very interested in being seen, but also desired deeply to receive moments wherein he could become invisible. And his journals seem to bear that out. The very personal writings in his diary seem to bear that out. And one, I think, can see some of that going on in what's nice about this show is that it's so complex. There are many different things going on. And I'm sure those of you who've seen this show before and are interested in it know that many people who have discussed this show are discussing it in terms of the artist coming to grips with his mortality, having been shot, and now in the last stage of his life. There are many deeply religious pieces in this show. There are pieces which seem to focus on mortality and violence in this show. And so I think that there are quiet moments that the artist desired in his life, as much as there were those moments hanging out with Debbie Harry and with other celebrities. There were also times when I think Warhol may have wanted to go back to the farm of his youth. And I think that that's there behind the surface of some of these extremely flat and extremely superficial, at least the way Warhol would describe them, paintings. And that's probably as good a point as any to wrap it up. I'm saving a little room for your questions, keeping in mind that I might not be able to answer everything, but I'll give it a stab. And I might even make something up if I can't. So, anyone? Yeah, I think it's about, you know, the nature of seriality is important to any printmaker. It's kind of what the print was born to do, right? Repeat an image, pre-Xerox, pre-photocopy, pre-photography. But I think for Warhol, there's something else going on that makes that a little bit more complex, and that is that he's speaking to the way American consumerism works in many of the pieces, which is about a repetition of imagery. So much so that when you close your eyes at night, you know, you're still seeing that Coors Light can, right? You're still seeing that thing that you want to buy. I think that's the nature of advertising, and I think that's the nature of American capitalism. But it's also become, in many ways, the nature of our political discourse, wherein, you know, the nature of a talking point is to say it again and again and again and again and again and again and again, so that it becomes the definition of what you're asking merely by nature of its repetition. So I think he's responding to that. I think that's going on here, and that's another one of those mirrors that Warhol offers us about ourselves, that there's something about this wonderful, wonderful experiment we've created called America that operates on repetition, on familiarity. Does that help? Do you have anything else to add?
No, it seems like with the urine pieces, that he's trying to say something that we consider ugly in this country and make it beautiful. Or he takes something that's sort of the now and then turns it into something spectacular. Mm-hmm. Like how right?
Yeah. There's a great quote that about art, and I think it was, I'll be at a loss to remember the actual artist's name, but one of the definitions I've always remembered as offered by this artist is that art makes the everyday sacred. And I think there might be something to that. Thanks, folks. Have a great day.